Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sadigaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
What does this say, Father? This is...
Yes, the first one is the Bhagavad Gita. There's one, but I did not find the other page 124.
Oh, this is another different book. Okay. Okay, Paramatma or Bhagavan. Bhagavan, the Supreme Person, is superior to Brahman, the impersonal divine effulgence, and Paramatma, the all-pervading supersoul. Still, one should not think that Brahman and Paramatma are two separate gods, and Bhagavan is the supreme god that dominates them. Here, the individual soul is the seer, and Bhagavan is the object seen. When he first sees his spiritual life, and he travels on the path of philosophical speculation, Jnana Marga, the soul sees the Brahman feature of Bhagavan. Then he comes, when he makes some advancement on this path, the soul begins to walk on the path of yoga, yoga marg. When he walks on that path, the soul sees the Paramatma feature of Bhagavan. Then by good fortune, the soul walks on the path of pure devotional service, Shuddha Bhakti marg. The soul sees Bhagavan directly. Bhagavan brings great sweetness to the eyes. He is full of transcendental bliss. He is eternal and full of knowledge and bliss. His form is graceful. He is a very handsome and charming person. He has all opulence, all power, all fame, all handsomeness, all knowledge, and all renunciation. He has them in the best, the most sublime way. Right? So, in starting the spiritual life, then the tendency is you're going to see Brahman, in that everything's, you know, coming from God, everything is, he pervades everything, he knows everything, this feature, this aspect. This is the Brahman aspect, how he's pervaded everything and all that. So as one goes, then one can start to see him in everything. Otherwise, you just know he's there, like that. You know, because sometimes you have a problem, okay, nature and the world, but then when you say something specific, then they start to get all, they can't quite work out what's matter and what's spirit. So then, with time, then you start to see Paramatma, because there's things to do, things not to do, what's right, what's wrong. Right? And Paramatma is the one who authorizes what you can do. You want to do something, he authorizes, the material nature carries it out. Right? So then that there. But then with time, then in Shuddha Bhakti, then we're seeing that as Krishna the person, we're doing it to please him the person. Right? Does that make sense? Because otherwise the tendency will be, I'm doing this because it's good. I'm not doing this because it's bad and I'll get a bad reaction. That's Paramatma level. Does that make sense? But when we're doing it because it pleases Krishna, the person, that's Bhagavan. You understand? So that's why any of these three, we feel we're connected to the Lord. Because the Lord is all three features. There's a non-difference. So one is connected, but there's a superiority to of the Bhagavan form to Brahman and Paramatma. Right? Is that personal interaction? Does that make sense? Yeah.
Now,
yes.
When it is a Paramatma feature, it's like we don't please Paramatma. We try to be pleased in contact with Paramatma.
Yeah, I mean, you can try to please, but the thing is you're following rules. And it's the rules. You're looking at the good and bad, the right and wrong aspect. But just on right means right. Means, in other words, we have this idea inherently. If I say that's right, or I say that's wrong, I haven't given any indication what it's in comparison to. But if I just say right or wrong, what do I put it in comparison to? No, but I say, hey, don't do that, that's wrong. People will accept, okay, it's wrong. But what's it in comparison to? What's the reason it's wrong? It's my values, I'll get a bad reaction. I say, don't do that, you know, it means, oh, if I do that, then something bad will happen to me. Or what is connected to me, or in some way, I will lose. In other words, the platform basically of artha, you know, that aspect, or let's say dharma, but from the karma aspect. Right? In other words, that element of karma is there. Does that make sense? So that would be the first. So we're accepting God on that Brahman platform, that he's all-pervading, he is everything, he knows all, sees all, like that. So we're not attributing to any particular feature. And then, you know, the next is right and wrong, which is actually the Paramatma level. As long as we understand that it's in connection with the Lord. So there's the theistic moralist, right? Because then there's the connection with God. That's why it's right and wrong. Otherwise, just the atheistic moralist, then he's going to, it's right and wrong simply because in the social situation, it's right or wrong. Does that make sense? It's right or wrong in the social situation, because that's all they care about. It's like, if it's socially good, then that's worthwhile. You don't really need the element of God just makes it work better. It's not that God's actually important. The importance is that your moralism goes nice. That's the element. The other one is that you do have a belief in God, but still it's about the moralism. Because God is there, therefore we have to be good, nice, everything. The focus is always on the moralism. Right? If you're dealing with actual pure theism, then it's about God, not about the moralism. Because the reason, why do you follow the rules? It pleases God. Why in this realm do we follow the rules? Because it ultimately pleases us. Right? Maybe I'm not mature enough or haven't understood enough to understand how proper action in public will benefit me in the future. Right? I just see, well, the restriction and everything like that. So that's because we're in there tending to think like that self-centered immoralist. Right? So then, there, you're just looking at what you're going to get benefit. But so when you expand it and they selfless, it's actually because you'll get benefit. There's no question that it'll be completely selfless. Mm-hmm. Right? You can only do that on the transcendental platform. But in the material world, we'll do it otherwise. Because the point is the body doesn't need anything. Mm-hmm. So why would be the importance of the maintenance of the body? Right? Because the soul doesn't need it. The body doesn't need it. The body didn't ask the soul to do it. So the soul's involved on its own position. Because it's what it wants. That's where the consciousness is. Right? So you can't get ultimately selfless in the material world. You can get something that basically looks like it. Right? Because that in the material world, that's as good as it gets. When it looks like what you're trying to get, that's as close as it gets. Because you can't guarantee that the mood and everything is right. As long as you can't see it, right? Because different moods and there's different external manifestations. So if the work is going nicely and by the symptoms that I can tell, the attitude's right, that's as good as it gets here. There is no such thing as actual full surrender or anything like that. Right? Because It's just the interaction that makes the modes of nature, means the body and everything, work, right, through the modes. Spiritual world, you have a spiritual body, and so that's the natural position, and then you can do everything for the Lord, right? Because you don't have to worry about maintaining the spiritual body. That is the soul. You know what I'm saying? So that's the... Yeah. Brahman and Paramatma are both hidden within Bhagavan. Bhagavan has all potencies. By his wish, his potencies manifest his regular and occasional pastimes. Right? So they're non-different because he's a person, so what he wants then gets done by his potencies. Right? Hey, what's the meaning? There's no... Why would you have desire if there's no way to carry it out? Right? Desire is there because there's actually a way to fulfill desire. Right? Does that make sense? So that aspect is there. So that's why the desire is still within the masculine area. Right? Because that's where the activity is going to be performed. But then it has to be performed. Right? So that desire is what connects to the goal, which is the feminine aspect. Right? Does that make sense? And then you have to actually make the endeavor. Right? Does that make sense? So that Prajumna, that's on the border, right? Because we see everything else has one thing. There's Vasudeva and Abhideya, Aniruddha and Prayojana. Right? Then Sankarshan is the field. But then you have Prajumna, which is where you're connecting the field, you know, to the goal through the activity. So it's a very, very pivotal point. Right? Because if a desire is not there, then there is no inspiration, there is no work. And if there's no work, there's no results. Does that make sense? Still, he is never bound by any rules or regulations. Bhagavan has no rival. No one is equal to him. No one is superior to him. That's why he's the element of his jealousy or elements like that is not because his position is... There's no question. You know, that 1/10,000th, the tip of the hair, can challenge unlimited. And the 1/10,000th tip of the hair is energy, which is dependent on the energetic. And the other is the energetic. So it's just no comparison at all. So it's impressive, as the Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was making the point that this is one of the great wonders of the world, is how something so small can think it's so great. You know? That is, you know, that goes alongside Yudhishthira's everybody dies, everybody knows everybody dies, but they won't think that I won't die. Like that. It's in that category. So for him, it's not a matter of competition. It's just a matter of how you deal with him. That's all. How you relate to God is how he reciprocates. That's all. So if you think, if it's like this, I want to be in charge, right? Because I have the Purusha Bhav. And if I get in charge, I want to maintain that in charge because I know everybody else is trying to be in charge. So therefore, I'll work very hard to see that nobody else gets in charge. Right? That's the attitude I have. So if we put that on, that God must be like that. So then if I do something wrong and I expect that he's going to be upset, then he'll manifest his upset. Because what does it matter? If you're... Let's say there's two guys and they're sitting in the desert, right? And they've been there for a while, right? So, you know, they're starting to see this wonderful oasis there, you know, all the coconut trees and that. And as they go along, then somebody, you know, one of the two says something the other one doesn't like. You know, and then over here, yeah, then we can put in a nice bungalow. And they're like, what do you mean bungalow? This is natural. We want to leave it natural, you know. You know what happens when you start introducing all... You know, does it matter? It's all an illusion. There's nothing there. Does that make sense? Right? And that's these two guys. Then if there's a third party there watching that, does it really matter to him? You know? You know what I'm saying? Now these guys turn to the third person and says, well, you adjudicate here, you know, so should we have a bungalow here or not? You know, and so then, okay, Okay, so what's your basis? What is your basis for having a bungalow? Why would you want a bungalow? And the other one, what you're not? And then see the arguments. And then, because now you've been asked to be a judge. So then judge means you judge on the evidence. Right? They didn't ask, does God want a bungalow there? Right? They didn't ask him, what would you do? They just, you know, this is what we're doing. Does that make sense? You know, that's the whole point, you know, is that one is turning to God because of things that one wants in oneself, rather than to please God. So that'll be the difference between them. Right? So he has no rival, so he never is upset or angry or this or that from that point of view. He gets upset if you bother the devotees, because that's actually detrimental to spiritual life. But anything else, what does it care? You have a smaller house, you have a bigger house, you have more things, you have less things. It doesn't matter because they're so inconsequential anyway. The only thing that matters, it matters to the individual living entity. So because it matters to the individual living entity, that's how you deal with it. You know what I'm saying? There's a doll, right? You know, some rag doll. Like that. The kid really likes his rag doll. Takes it everywhere, does everything, talks with it, sits, has breakfast with it, does everything. So, does the mother really care about the rag doll? No. But, because the rag doll is important to the kid, therefore, the parent deals with the rag doll in connection with the kid. You know, if the kid's got something or didn't feel, you know, got too excited or, you know, is not feeling good and they walk off and leave the rag doll, oh, you're not taking the doll with you? You know? Oh, yes, you know, then they. Does that make sense? So that's the level on where the Lord is dealing. It's important to us. That's why he's dealing in that area. It's not that it's important to him, but we'll think because it's important to me, it's important to God. Like that. Does that make sense? So it's not he has to establish or, you know, so someone can be an atheist, who cares? It's just like if you walk up to somebody and say, you don't exist, you're not here, you're just a figment of my imagination. You know, it's kind of like, you know, hello? It's like, you know, what has this got to do with anything? And they say, it doesn't mean anything. So even nobody bothers him, you know?
Like that. Doesn't Krishna feel bad because we're not personally, but because we're in such illusion?
That's there. But we're thinking he's upset because of the particular activity. You know, what's been done on the platform of the body, mind, and words. Because we look at activity as gives a result. So on karma. So therefore, then God will be upset because of the way we're doing it. We're not looking at it that the living entity is suffering and he's an illusion, right? I mean, the natural thing is that the two guys are sitting there hallucinating in the desert, you naturally think, well, these guys need some water, right? You know, they need some water, some shade, like that. But, you know, you tell them that, why do we want your water? We have this whole reservoir here. Yeah, what is this, you know, water in a bottle? We're natural guys. We have the natural, you know, it's like they won't take it, you know, then what to do? You know, hey, come over here. You can sit in the shade. What do you mean? We got these nice coconut trees here. What are you talking about? You know? So that's what's happening. So it's the idea is that God does not have to establish himself for his own benefit. He establishes himself for our benefit. But for his benefit, there's no need. You know what I'm saying? You know, you have the world heavyweight champion, you know, and a, you know, out of control 3-year-old, you know, and he's, you know, beating his kneecaps there, you know. It's not, there's no contest here, you know, like that. He has spiritual potency. His spiritual potencies are multifarious. They have many different powers. By these spiritual potencies, Bhagavan's spiritual abode, spiritual pastimes, and spiritual paraphernalia are all manifest. So it's him. He wants to manifest it, and so it's manifested by his will. Right? Because this is the importance where it's non-different from him. Because his abode, everything is manifest by his. That are all transformations of Bhagavan's spiritual potency. Right? So these are transformations, so that's why the material world will naturally also be a transformation of its potencies, but not spiritual potency, material potency. Right? The material world is a transformation of the material potency. The spiritual world is a transformation of the spiritual potency. Right? From his perfect spiritual potency, the spiritual world is manifest. Bhagavan's potency acts in many different ways. One kind of action it performs is the manifestation of the many atoms. That is seen. Spiritual effulgence, spiritual qualities, and spiritual activities are all manifest from Bhagavan's spiritual potency. So all the, whatever the atoms, that what everything's made out of, is all manifest by the potency. So then here you have the spiritual and you have the material. Does that make sense? The point is what's manifest is manifest through that potency. Like that. From the jiva shakti potency, the individual spirit souls, jivas, are manifest. The spiritual potency has a shadow. From that shadow are manifest the five gross material elements, the five sense objects, the 10 senses, the mind, the intelligence, and false ego. In this way, 24 material elements are manifest, right? So, five gross elements, the five sense objects, it's 10, the 10 senses, 20, the mind, 21, intelligence, 22, and false ego, 23. Okay, the potency that manifests the material world is just called the Chaya Shakti, shadow potency. I think this 24th is the Pradhan. Because then someone will say, what about the modes of nature? And you know, and then he had Brahma in the beginning created, what was that? Lust, anger, greed, illusion, madness.
Fear of death.
And death. Then that's another group, I think. That's another group. So all these things. So some take it that the material elements are much more, because they add those in. But this particular group, while we use this, this is what Lord Chaitanya used. Right? Because these are more directly elements. Right? While the other things are the various moods in which the elements are used. So no less important, but just more subtle. Like that. So that's sometimes even your list will be different, what you put together. Because it's just a matter of what is your purpose in bringing out. But this is your standard because that's what it is. In other words, the senses, the sense objects, means how you say, that are made out of the five elements, and then the mind, intelligence, false ego, that is what deals with it. So this 20 group of 24 is how you're interacting in the world and the world you're interacting with. Why you're doing that, what particular, that's your modes of nature, the, all this different, the illusion, madness, illusion, fear of death, all these different things. Does that make sense?
How is the 16 categorized out of these? Which ones?
You'll take the... okay, so then you'll get the five gross elements... and the senses, sense objects. It means the senses and the sense objects. So it'll be 15. Then you have the mind. Because the mind includes the senses, like the 10 senses, and includes intelligence and false ego. Does that make sense? In other words, the Mahabhutas are always in every list. Like, because the senses are operated by the mind. If the mind's not there, they're not there. They're just basically extensions of that. So that way, those 11 you can count as 1 or as 11. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. So like that. You can even do it by 9. You have the 5 gross elements. I think, and then these mind, intelligence, and false ego. Because the point is the sense objects are connected to the senses. Right? So like that, it just depends upon what is the reason of your explanation of the, that then that will be used. Right? Does that make sense? If you're talking about the workings, you'd want to use the 24. The 16 is just, you know, what's there. Like that. And then the 9 will be even less. It'll just be, you know, there's the material energy and then there's all the subtleties that go along with it. Is that
what's in the Pradhan that's not in these 23 elements?
Pradhan is just the because you need volume. You know what I'm saying? It's just like you have some cash in your hand and you're able to do something, but the volume of money that's there in the banks and in this and that, that's then makes it actually work. You know. So the point is that the coverings of the universe, all the, you know, all the extra earth atoms, because this at some point will just fall apart. So it goes back to that and then comes back again. You know, so that kind of unmanifest. This also is that makes a distinction between Pradhan and Mahat. So Pradhan is just the material energy itself, because that's what you're actually working with. But because the living entity is there with his polluted consciousness and the false ego, or time, excuse me. Yeah, false ego, time, all this, then it separates as Mahat. So generally in discussions you don't work with Pradhan so much, but if you get into the subtle elements, subtlety of it, because we tend to give life to the external energy. Maya herself is, but the dead matter is not. So the tendency is that we take it that the dead matter is alive and it has, you know, it's doing all these things, but it's not. It's just sitting there. So that aspect of it is important for analyzation and Shankya. It's important. Because then you make the distinction that the atoms of brick are just sitting there. But the point is what's important is the form that you can make a column, the form of that it's done with bricks, and that combination of bricks and cement. And that if you do it in a particular way, it manifests a certain amount of the strength opulence. And then that, in proportion with all the others, is enough to hold up the weight of the building. Right? So the thing is the atoms and all that aren't the main point, because it means you're always using earth elements, but which ones and all that, so there's rules on what you can do. Does that make sense? Well, let's say a hot air balloon is not held up by earth; it's held up by fire. You know, so there's different things at the same time as it's the air holding. You know, so I mean, it's all interrelated. But the ability to distinguish between what is the spirit in matter and what is the matter itself. Because technically we say all these senses and everything, because here it was pointing out, because we're looking at this. That's why it says the soul is the seer, Bhagavan is the object seen. But technically if you get right into it, because this is talking on that level, but when you get up to the level of jnana yoga, then you have another principle, the Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur would push more, because this one we're comfortable with. But he would actually bring it to the point as, no, it's a universal form. He's seen, you're the seen. So, you know, you're eating something. You know, who's doing the eating and who's being eaten? We're thinking, I'm eating the food. No, the food is involving you. Because Krishna is the food, the senses, all these different things, all this is going on, we're just part of that. But because of false ego, we think I'm the doer. So it's a comfortable position to work from, because now you're learning to use that position in a nice way, because you don't analyze like this in the spiritual world. It's all about the devotion to the Lord. Right? So it's important for separating between matter and spirit. Once you're situated in spirit and can make the distinction within spirit, right? Then you don't require it. That's why once you get to the platform of bhava, jnana is its service is done. There is no more need for it, because now it's a matter of perfecting the mood, the attitude, the focus, like that. It was useful here because our attitude, focus, our mood, our endeavor was totally material. So it's used to separate matter from spirit. Does that make sense? So therefore, the mind, all these are energies of the Lord. And then, but dead matter is another energy, but they're different. Yes. Does that make sense? Because one has the like seemingly energetic aspect, the other doesn't. So it's kind of, yes.
Is Maya conscious of Pradhan in a similar way to we're conscious of the body?
That I know of, but then that would be kind of like your existence mode, that aspect. You know, just that sat aspect. Right? But she eternally is, you know, with her husband, like that, but she is the lord of that energy. So there's a non-difference.
Some awareness.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, but the point is it's not that the matter itself, other than her, is unconscious. So in other words, she'll be upset because it's not supposed to be used in that way.
Yes.
Therefore, you get punished. Right? As we discussed before, if you do a pious activity, why do you get rewarded? Because it's still material. Right? And she has nothing to gain from it. So it's because that is useful in devotional service, though you're not interested in devotional service. That's why you just get the mundane result. Right? And when you do something that's impious, it's not useful in devotional service. That's why it's there. So as you're increasing your piety, you're increasing your potential in devotional service in the form. Not that you're doing it, but your potential is there. Does that make sense? You know, like you've gone out and you've collected more, what do you call it? You know, supplies in the larder. These things don't. I'm starting to really get worried now. All these terminologies and stuff that before had some meaning don't have any meaning anymore. Yeah, I guess because now it's just a shelf. Before it was generally there'd be rooms where you kept all the edibles, the grains, the dry goods and everything like that. And you might also have your vegetables, your fruits, your other things like that. So that place is called a larder, right? And so those things that are in there, they have a name. It's just that one doesn't. Oh, well, you got the idea. So somebody's collecting things for the kitchen like that. But if it's not, so if it's collecting things for there, then it's good. If they're letting them go bad and not dealing with them, you know, like the top's left off of something, it goes bad or gets full of bugs or like that, that'll be considered bad. But in any case, it's the important thing is cooking. So you can't say it's cooking. Pious activities aren't devotional service because devotional service is something else. Cooking is different than collecting having the nice stuff. So that's then where you see is do you cook for Krishna or do you cook not? So it's just potential. Right? So in other words, the potential is you have collected the activities, the mentality, the facilities, and everything that could be used in devotional service in a favorable way. Or you're not. Does that make sense? Right? The proper performance of your duties gives results, so you don't have to steal. Stealing means you're not performing your prescribed duties. Right? Thievery is not a prescribed duty. Right? You may have people who are professional thieves, you know, so you can say, no, but that's our group, that's our profession. But it's not. Your prescribed duties are to engage your activities. Does that make sense? Yeah. So you perform your prescribed duties, then that's good. Because you perform your prescribed duties in relationship to Krishna consciousness. Then one advances. You perform your prescribed duties not in relation to Krishna consciousness. At least you're doing the right activity, though you haven't understood the right mentality. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? You know, it's just like the person is cooking and they're doing quite good at it. But it's only for themselves what they like. They're not interested in cooking for anybody else or making any adjustments because anybody else likes it different. So you consider on the cooking level, they're good. They're quite good cooks. But as far as the attitude, then not useful. Right? Because they wouldn't be able to do anything for the rest of the family or to have a party or do anything like a restaurant or any kind of program because they'll only do it the way they like it. So, I mean, okay, if you like some of the preps that they like and you then decide, okay, that's what you're going to cook, then it's fine. But what if he says, no, but, you know, this is a big festival. I don't want to cook that. I want to cook this. But nobody likes that. You understand? So it's the idea is that that you're doing pious activities, you're getting a good result because it's the correct form and activity, but wrong attitude. So now it's just you correct the attitude, then it's good. Right? Does that make sense? And then you have those with they have a nicer attitude, pious attitude, but not necessarily the pious activities. You know, the world love and peace and free love and everybody love each other and all. It's a nice attitude, but they don't engage in. But are their activities pious? They're dirty. They take intoxication. They're into illicit sex. Right? You know, I mean, you know, they go out into nature and liberate things there, but even if it's in someone's backyard, if it's early morning or if they're an old codger, it's too much that they couldn't use. If it's a small amount, they won't bother. But if there's a lot like that, then they'll liberate it, quote unquote. Right? They're stealing, but, you know, pleasantly stealing, right? You know, they didn't mean anything by it. You understand? But so here's the attitude's very nice, but the lifestyle is just downright sinful. So here you have the case where attitude's nice, but in either case, there's some positive result from it. Because one, the attitude is good, they get a result from that. So they get results on the mental platform, the mental emotional platform. The other one, he's getting it on the physical platform. He gets the stuff and all that, though he doesn't have the right attitude, so he doesn't enjoy it. Does that make sense? So wherever you do something right, you will be rewarded there. But things aren't actually right until it's Krishna conscious. That's the point Narad Muni is making now to the Prachetas. All these nice spiritual activities still mean nothing if they're not connected to the Lord. Though they're important. So pious activities are important. Morality is important. It's all important. Knowledge is important. The social elements are important. But if they're not connected to the Lord, they are useless. There isn't another. It's like, if they're not connected to the Lord, it's not ideal. It's still good. No, it's just useless. So misapplied first-class activities. Right? And it's only first-class because they're able to be used in devotional service. So that's the definition on what use it is. Does that make sense? That's the whole point. That's the element. Let's say, okay, why in puja you wear a dhoti and not pants? Right? Because you can say, well, they both do the same thing, they cover up your legs, like that. But now, what's a very important element in deity worship?
Cleanliness,
okay? Cleanliness, time, punctuality, a sense of detachment. Are these not important elements? Right? If you're doing, you don't do the puja for because you'll get the benefit. You get because it pleases Krishna. So that means a sense of detachment. Krishna is the supreme pure. He likes everything pure, right? And everything on time. Okay. Now, the dhoti, by nature, it's a single piece of cloth. It's clean. It's very easy to wash. You hang it up. It dries very fast. Right? Does that make sense? And how much do you need? Because it's easy to take care of in that. You only need a few pieces. Okay, pants, they're sewn. All right? So that means automatically there's dirty because where it's sewn, where you make the seam, dust can get inside. You can't get the dust out of the seam inside. It just gets in there and it doesn't come out. You know, a few bits may fall out, a few more may go in, but the point is it's not clean. So that element, it's not ideal, therefore. Okay. Now, as far as that aspect, now what about the simplicity? You wash a pair of pants, hang them up, how long does it take to dry? A long time. And the point is so how do, of course, in the West, they solve that by, you know, washing it once a week. Okay? But that still then doesn't help in the cleanliness area. Right? Does that make sense? So then that means then you would have to have so many sets of these pants, right? Just so that they would dry, because on time they won't dry on time. And so, because of that, if you want to solve that problem, then you have to have more. So your volume of material involvement gets greater. Does that make sense? And then there's the whole thing: is this the dhoti is just simple? You can put it on in very different ways, and no matter how you put it on, it's still all right. It means it either looks okay or it looks good. Someone really knows how to put it on, it looks good. They don't know how to put it on. It doesn't look bad. It's okay. Right? But the pants, it's about its cut, it's about this and that. So you have all these fashion elements, all these other material elements. You can't just, it means the dhoti, you just get some cloth, rip it, or just buy it as it. But the other one, you have to get it tailored, or you have to go to special stores, you have to see if it fits. And then after 6 months, it doesn't fit anymore. You know, and then what do you do with all this? Right, you know, your dhoti, you can make it into other things. Make it into, you know, a rag or put it on your bed. You can, you know, you can take your dhoti and put it on the bed. Use it as a bed sheet. You can't put your pants on your bed and make it into a bed sheet. Maybe if you sewed them all together, like a patchwork pant quilt or something. You know, very ancient, you know, practiced by the Quakers, I think it was. Does that make sense? Yeah, so either that or maybe that's what they, you know, would shred up and then put in their guns when they would make the puffed rice, right? No? Something, you have to use something to get the energy to puff the rice. I'm sure this is way over anybody, most anybody's head. Yeah. Yes.
Marge, with the list of 24, sometimes... conditioned consciousness is said to be the 24th. Is that the same
affair? It means you can use that. You can use, that's what I'm saying, depending on what you want to bring out.
Mm-hmm. Is there some relation between conditioned consciousness and pranada? Is
it? Well, you can say it's the basis on which everything is functioning. Because pradana, then there's everything else, but without the consciousness, then it wouldn't be there in the first place. So pradana turned into mahat because of the consciousness. Polluted consciousness is there. When you add that, that is that false ego that I'm the control of the joy. Because there is no, it means how do you, you can't use the element false ego, you know, from pradana. You have to use something that's there before. So that's the polluted consciousness. So that false ego that I'm the control of the joy. That by being added to pradana, then is a catalyst that makes it then separate into the elements. Right? So in other words, the first thing you get then is false ego. Add it again, then you'll get intelligence. Add it again, you get something. So each time, each one as you go, there's more and more false ego. Does that make sense?
That's why Lord Shiva enters with the glance.
With?
Mahavishnu.
Yes, yeah. That glance is Sadashiva. So earth is the grossest false ego. So that's where we identify. I am the body. I am this house. I am this country. You know, because it's earth. You can see it. Is that okay?
Okay. Tanmatra, the subtle aspect of the senses.
Yeah, they're. That's the sense objects.
Tanmatra is the sense object.
No, it's not. That's that potency of sense. So then you get that also. Because you can do that, and then the senses, you're not counting the working senses. That's used when you're talking about the knowledge acquiring senses. So you have the five senses, you have the five sense objects, and then you have the sense itself. In the sense of smell, sense of taste, sense of that. So that's 15. That with the mind is then what works everything. So that's another way to put together 16. So that way then you get 20 right there. You know. So that means 15, and then you add the Mahabhutas, and then you add these others. So then, so it's just a matter of just how which ones you put in here. You know, does that make sense? Yeah. So like arts, there's 64 arts. So but there's more than that of arts, but it's just 64 is what is prominent, what you use. Like that. That makes sense. Like Krishna's 64 arts and Radharani's, there's some slight differences in detail. This has that mark on it, so this must be the other one. Yeah, he's the moralist. Six of the ships are leaving. Okay, that's the difference. This is the six ships. Yeah. By the way, I have two marches and one lesson. Oh no, this is from the Shiksha Lita. This is quite confusing. Okay, got your advice on that. That's a 7. What follows in it? Okay, so that was there. So now here's it. So this is here.
And we have a new page.
Right? Page 6 is what follows as an excerpt, right?
Yes.
Okay. What follows is an excerpt from Bhaktivinoda Thakura's Chaitanya Shikshamrita, chapter 5, dealing with the realization of the Supreme Lord. Realization of the Lord is of three types: Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Brahman refers to an unqualified conception of the Lord, which is opposite of the material world endowed qualities. The Supreme Lord is self-revealing. Those who cultivate knowledge realize the Lord in these three ways. The appearance of the Lord as unequaled by drilling the mind until it arrives at a negative conception is called Brahman. Right? In other words, you're removing everything and what's removed, then that's Brahman. Mm-hmm. Right. So in other words, like we were saying, when we're dealing with the pillar, we're removing the bricks, we're removing the sand, those things, and what we're left is the strength of the bricks and sand. You know, the concept of a pillar, the activity that a pillar performs. That's what's left. That's Brahman. The other is not Brahman. So that's what they spend their time doing, is removing the material elements and just what's left. But unfortunately, because then that's qualities, they aren't able to do it so easily. You know what I'm saying? Is that we can show, you know, anybody how to function on that Brahman platform very easily, because the concept of the Supreme Lord and His potencies are there. But if you're trying to do that without, it's just all there's left is you take away this and all there's left is Brahman, that's very hard to deal with. So if one is very purified, then one might be able to do these things, you know, to some degree. But for the devotee, even the newest person can deal with it. That's why we see is that the in the second canto, then it's defined that this understanding of the universal form is to purify the impersonalist. Right? So we'll say, oh, so it has nothing to do with us. Great. But the problem is if you're not, you know, pure Vaishnava, then what's not pure about the pure Vaishnavism is the impersonalism. Right? As it's been defined by Bhaktivinoda Thakura, there is Vaishnavism, then there's Advaitavad. Right? Then you have so many forms of Advaitavad. So it even takes on, it looks as though it might even be religious and personal. But it's not necessarily, because ultimately it's all about I'm God and not God. Right. So then. So this aspect is that we're saying, you know, it gives all the examples, but it's just throwing out examples. You know, the light of the sun and the moon and this and that, because we like the sun and moon. Why are people lying out on the beach? Right? Because the sun has light. If a cloud comes, the sun's still light. But they're not appreciating the light, so then they get up and, you know, go do something else. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the problem is that it's seen, but it's not appreciated what you're seeing. So the whole point of being out in the sun is the light. Right? In the morning when the sun comes up, it's light. You can do all your work because it's light. So that's the aspect of the sun that is the Lord. That's the Brahman aspect. So in other words, you're trying to change the impersonal impersonalist to a personalist. Right? In other words, you're seeing the impersonal aspects because it's just the light of the sun. It's not Krishna's natural effulgence. Yes. Krishna's bright. He's that. That's personal then. Right? Does that make sense? You know, or the beauty in something, or the power in something, the wealth, all these six opulences, we're seeing these in whatever is of importance to us. Right? So, in other words, everyone's attracted to the six opulences. It's just a matter of how. Okay? Now let's say the sage, right? He's detached. So he's not interested in the material endeavor. So is that an attractive feature in the saintly person, that they're detached from the material world? Okay? Okay. Now let us say you have another person. They're very intelligent. They have good karma. They're educated. They're very fashionably up to date. And so when they're just standing on the street amongst so many other people, what's the mood that they project? Detached. Right? Generally you use the word it's cool, or you know, they look confident or like that. But it's detachment. Because they just don't care about anybody else there on the street. Why? Because everybody else on the street is worried about, well, what do they think? What is this one there? What is that? You know, they're worried about it. They're attached. So here's a person who's detached. Naturally, they're attractive. But now, what modes have generated the detachment of the sage and the detachment of this fashionable person? One's the mode of goodness, one's passion and ignorance. Does that make sense? Yeah. Just thinking, how do we get into that? Because that was the foundation for making the point. That's the problem. Sometimes you get into the example so well that you forget why you were using the example. Oh, okay. So what we're doing is we're using the same principle, but now becoming aware that what we're looking for is God. You know, and so we're bringing it from the mode. The point is the universal form is given in connection to everything. So it's just generic. Then you can apply it to the situation you're in. So that's why a lot of times devotees will think by reading that second canto of Bhagavatam or the seventh, tenth, and eleventh of the Gita, that this doesn't have any connection with me. No, it's totally connected because all those points that are making, everybody's interested in. Now, which modes of nature you're looking at it from, right? So this other guy may not care about the sage, and the sage definitely doesn't care about the fashionable guy, right? So the point is what modes are there is then you look at it, so it's now a proper thing of applying it practically, that what we're looking for, right? Like rain, why is rain considered good?
For land. It's good for agriculture.
Yes, so do that. Because so, and what is it? But the rain is the semen of the universal form. So what does semen do? Makes things happen, make things grow. Gives life. You know what I'm saying? So that's why people are looking at it. Does that make sense? But it's not connected like that. We'll just look at it, oh, it's raining, so, you know, it's good because then the crops will grow and I'll make money. Or it's raining and now I'm going to get wet. You know, all I had to do was go across the street, you know. Does that make sense? So the point is that we're just focusing on what our a little lifestyle. We're not seeing it in connection. So that aspect is being able to appreciate the Brahman. But what it is when you take away the external, you're left with the qualities of Bhagavan. So that's easy because that's natural, that's real. The idea that you strip away the external and there's no qualities, that's artificial. That's why it's so difficult. So the one you can teach to anybody. The other one, you'd have to be very, very qualified in the mode of goodness and practice a very austere, regulated lifestyle to appreciate. And if you say, no, but I know Western karmis, no, in their last life they were doing this. They didn't do anything to cultivate it. It's a very, very difficult platform.
There's nothing positive to
remove. It's nothing positive. All you're doing is removing it down the negative. So what we've done is removed it down to the negative. So we're looking at the negative means. The matter is not that. It's not spirit. You know, or when we're saying I am that means I am spirit, I'm not matter. It doesn't mean I'm that spirit, because there's a variety of spirit. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like you've been out traveling, you come back to your country, so now you can say, now I'm with my countrymen. But you don't become the country. It's not that when you go back to your country, you become the country. You know what I'm saying? So you can tell the difference, right? Because there's a country, therefore you can identify with the country. So because there's a Supreme Brahman, I can identify with that Supreme Brahman as Brahman. But we're Jiva Brahman, and that's Supreme Brahman.
If we don't have a correct understanding about Brahman is only a concept.
Yeah, it's only a concept to us. The Brahman is there. There's no question of Brahman's not there. Because the thing is there is such a thing as Nirguna Brahman. Yes. That means Brahman that doesn't have any material concepts about it. So it's one of the qualities of Saguna Brahman. To be Nirguna is a quality. Right? So it's one of the qualities of Nirguna of Saguna Brahman is that it's Nirguna. Because Saguna means it's all transcendental qualities. Nirguna means there's no material qualities. Like that. But just the function that there's only Nirguna Brahman, then that becomes overly difficult to function. Is that okay? It is not the eternal form of the Lord means this negative concept. If the introspective person is not exposed to a Dvaitavad, then by this process a slight realization of the Lord can be attained. Because right? Then you can understand Krishna's greatness, how he's in everything and all that. But the point is the person is doing it. So why is the person entering into everything? Why did he take the form of Mahavishnu and Garbhodakshaya Vishnu and Kiradakshaya Vishnu and then expand everything, enter into everything, make everything work, manage it all? Why would he do that unless he cares about the individual living entities? Right? Because you don't go to that much trouble to make a prison nice. You know what I'm saying? It means old prisons were a very large room with very thick walls and, you know, minimal, you know, and very secure. So that meant minimal, light. Right? So you have a small window with bars in it. Because if you have a big window with bars in it, long bars you can bend, short ones you can't. Right? And the only reason you have a window at all is because if it's dark, then you have to spend money on lamps and electricity. So, therefore, if you have that little window, then you don't have to worry about it, right? And when the sun goes down, they're supposed to be asleep anyway. Right? Does that make sense? You know, so it doesn't require much. Does that make sense? So everything, the jail is nice, stainless steel, very solid, very expensive. Why? Because otherwise the criminals break it. So you have to make something very strong that they can't break it. Right? You know, the toilet seat can't come off because then they've used it to kill somebody. So this toilet seat is built in. It's one piece. Right? There's no handle on the flushing mechanism. You can take it off and use it to punch somebody. Right? So it's just something that you can't do that. So, therefore, it's very elaborate. You know what I'm saying? So, one, things in the material world are elaborate, because if it's not, then everybody goes crazy. Because all you require is the cell. But because they go crazy, therefore you have a yard. You know what I'm saying? You have things to do. But ultimately, why so much trouble is gone to is because of the care for, right? Because as we described, now that original thing, what I mentioned in the way of the jail, it's now, typically called a dungeon. right? And so now there's laws about dungeons. Why? Because they care about the criminal.
Yes.
So you try to make a nicer arrangement for the criminal. So it's care. So why would God make a nice arrangement in the material world unless he cared about the living entity? Right? Because all it just has to be, you know, why do you need the sun and moon? They can all just float around here. They can just float around in Brahman and get bored. You know what I'm saying? It's just, the nice thing about it is you're floating around in Brahman, you don't have any hair to pull out anyway. So you can be totally freaking out, and there's nothing you can do about it. You know? Does that make sense? But Krishna cares, so he's made these arrangements. Okay, so that's what, if the introspective person is not exposed to Dvaitavada, then by this process, a slight realization of the Lord can be attained. You can appreciate God's position, His nature, His supremacy, and all the things, and how He's doing all this nicely. But though it may be called godly realization, is very general and not productive for bliss. It may produce some peace. You have some knowledge, and some, but it doesn't produce bliss. It removes the negative. Now you know, okay, there's something there, but it doesn't create the bliss. Right? But removing distress in the material world is called happiness, therefore the person in the material world will call it happiness.
Yes.
But it's not actually happiness.
It's a start.
It's a start. It's a positive start. Now, for here, for the devotee, because they are also, means we're here, we're talking about someone who hasn't necessarily taken up devotional service, but they come in contact with things and they haven't come in contact with the Dvaitavada. So here you have your proper more, your Brahmavada. You can appreciate. A small degree of rati may be experienced, right? That attraction, that attachment, that, like that. But without a relationship in that realization, rati cannot grow. So that means that's the limit that you can get in Shantaras. That's why it's not recommended. You've come to the point, realization, you appreciate the position of the Lord and all that, but it hasn't increased to the point where that when there's an increase in understanding or like that, then there's a desire of service. Like that. So it hasn't come to that. One is just satisfied with that much understanding. But when you start to see Bhagavan Paramatma, then you want to serve. Does that make sense? The Kumaras fixed in such a state are an example of Shantarati. Right? In other words, there's attraction to that, to the Lord, but it won't grow beyond that because you're not increasing your understanding. Because it's a static element that everything's Brahman. There's not something more to learn or understand in that area. Because you're only aware of so much, and if you're aware of Brahman and all that, it's not that there's something more in that area.
Is there a difference between Brahman realization and merging in Brahman in the sense of coming to the stage of non-duality?
There is that you don't have a form. So, in one sense, you can say the Kumaras are merged in Brahman, but they still have a body. So then if they, in this state, leave the body, then they'll just be without a body merged in Brahman.
But if they have a sense of identity, then there would be duality. Brahman.
No, that's just this word Brahman. Because for them, it's all Brahman. The point is the oneness of the oneness is that everything is Brahman. It's not that there can't be varieties of Brahman. Because the point is you're seeing Brahman in everything, but it's Brahman that's pervading everything. So you can see everything back to that supreme Brahman, and then there may be other aspects of Brahman. So that aspect's there. The Mayavada is their philosophy. That's why I said here in the Dvaitavada, meaning that like the Mayavada philosophy. Because then you actually get a polluted sense of this Brahman. So you can't get this rati from there. They don't get a taste. It's too dry. So you get up there and it's just nothingness. That's why the Buddhists, the Mayavadis, they get up to that top level. It just, as the higher you go, the drier and drier it gets. You know, like that. Supreme dryness.
Well, how is it that it seems like the Buddhists have ended up today as psychologists? How did they, hear the Buddhist talk? It's all about talking about the mind. So intertwined with psychology. So how did they end up as?
Because they bumped into the Bengalis. the Bengalis are very thoughtful, and they're into Tantra. So from time immemorial, Buddhism has been mixed with Tantra. But generally, you're more ritualistic elements of more philosophical aspects of Tantra. So then that ends, gives that all those different aspects. It's all of it's Tantra. It's just how Tantra, like that, they get into it. You know, how much left is there. But it's always going to be that. It's just now if they drop the rituals and the knowledge, then you get the Sahajayan, and that's from where you get into, they convert it into, when they converted to Vaishnavism, then they became the Sahajiyas. Like that. So that's slightly different, but the it's always been there, because the conditioned soul won't be able to function on pure Buddhism. Like that. Because pure Buddhism, there is nothing. There is nothing there. You just, in other words, since you're in the body, you go out begging every day, and then the rest of the time you spend just talking about nothing. Or experiencing the nothingness. The soul being Satchitananda, then those elements have to come out. And so why that works in that way, then you're going to have to look at it. So then the psychology will be very important to them for analyzing why they're not on that platform of nirvana. Because the mind is always conditioning them to not work that way. But then the problem is the psychologically the alternative that I'm nothing and you know, I have no past experience of anything. That state to get to, how would you actually deal with that? Because that's, you're working within the material elements. You won't be able to, they won't be able to work in nothingness. Because even if we say nothing, we take it as something. There's a form of that nothingness. It's not pure nothingness, that's nothing's there. So that's the point, is up to there, is that as long as they can visualize the nothingness and experience the nothingness, then that's okay. But the point is you can't experience nothing. You can experience something. You know, and the experience, and they think the experience is good, but an experience is something, but you're trying to get to nothing. So it should be that nothing should give no experience. You know what I'm saying? So it doesn't actually fly as a philosophy. So all they do is then speculate on the workings. Now, how much they understand, I would expect they have more of an understanding of the technicalities of how the mind works. But even then, it's going to have these two flaws, because their samskara and their identity is always going to have to be connected with something. So then whatever they connect it to, it'll be governed by those modes. So only the devotee is the samskara's past devotional service, and the present identity is servant of Krishna. So therefore then you can see, you know, spiritually, you can act spiritually, you can get spiritual results, you can be situated on the spiritual platform. And that's easy, it's natural. Because all it is this mind has covered that mind. This intelligence has covered that, this sense is that. You know, but then you're trying to work with nothing. That's impossible. Because if it's nothing anyway, why do you have to make the endeavor? And if you're in anxiety, what does it matter? You don't exist. So why are you worried about being anxiety? You don't exist to, you know, that you should worry about anxiety. In fact, you exist. Your anxiety isn't actually even there. And the things you're worried about aren't even there. So it's all nothing. So how is that somehow another improvement? You know, you're dealing with a person. It's just not an improvement. That's the sad part. Does that make sense? So the Vedic psychology, if you understand that, then you're coming in from the septic platform, much more useful in our philosophy. So that kind of thing, if you're into, then Sarathamaras is that talk. Vedanta psychology, that just shows how it works from that platform. And then Bhaktivinoda Thakur gives a, you know, clear explanation in the Jiva Dharma. It's simple, but it's okay, so Kumara is fixed in such a state, an example of Shantarati. Right? But then they add in the Lord, you know, more, and then you can go more. The next realization is Paramatma. In the third stage of knowledge where God is accepted, the final stage is realization of Paramatma. Okay. In here, when it says here, the next realization is Paramatma. We've dealt with Brahman. This is in the Vritti. In the third stage of knowledge where God is accepted, the final stage is realization of Paramatma. Which third stage is this referring to?
Final stage? He's saying third stage.
But that third stage means Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. The third stage means, theistic moralist. The third stage means...
That sounds to me like a Bhagavan realization.
Bhagavan. Okay, where God is accepted. The final stage is Paramatma. Okay, realization of the Lord is the bestower of results to the conditioned souls, the director of all actions who pervades the universe is called Paramatma. So in other words, to be accepted that God's a person, but all you're looking at of the person is these aspects of bestower of results of the conditioned souls of actions and pervading.
Third stage of knowledge, this is the theistic moralist.
Theistic moralist, okay. Yeah. Okay. So okay.
Sir, I apologize. I have a better quality print for you. It'll be easier to read, I think.
It goes the same.
Yeah,
same.
It's just those three pages turned up poorly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Should I give these back?
Sure.
The form of the Lord, which is the object of meditation in Astanga Yoga, is this Paramatma, either imaginary or real. In scriptures, Paramatma is called Purusha. So imaginary or real is that you can either, you know he exists, that God exists, and this is the Lord, and you're meditating, therefore, directly on God. You know, it means, in other words, if he has a form, he's Bhagavan, but you're only acknowledging the aspects of him that is Paramatma. You're only acknowledging the localized areas. Or imaginary is you just feel that this is the form of the mode of goodness that is recommended by Patanjali to meditate on, but ultimately there, you know, God is formless. Does that make sense?
Was the first time you described the meaning, imaginary meaning is your forming that image of the Lord
with
your mind, and real
meaning
to directly experience it?
It can be. You can also, there is that in the meditation when it gets to samadhi, then before that it is just the imagining in the mind, and at the same time is then when you get to the thing, you're directly seeing the Lord. But at the same time is the form of the Lord, if it's a bona fide form, thought of in the mind, is one of the deities. It's just making a distinction between the Swayam and the deity form here. So you can take it that way, or you can take it on whether they believe in the eternal form of the Lord or it's the temporary form. Right? In other words, they're imagining within the mind either the eternal form or the temporary form. And then when they come to realize, then they realize the actual Swayam form. Now, but if your consciousness is that this form is temporary, then you'll merge into the form. And if you don't, then you don't. So, in other words, the Paramatma stage is in between the two. So it's not something that the living entity will stay on. Right? It means it's either, if you're worshipping the person, now is this person actually a person? So you move forward to Bhagavan, or they're not actually a person and move back to Brahman. Right? Does that make sense? But the problem is Brahman doesn't seem to be the one giving facility. Right? You do good work, who's giving the results of the good work? It has to be a person. I'm a person, I did work, therefore another person has to then give the results. So that's Paramatma. So we're seeing God as who gives the results of our work.
So merging into Paramatma, merging into Brahman, what's the
same?
Like you say, it's the same.
They're same. They're the same. Mm-hmm. You end up the same. The difference is you think you're merging into the person. You can even think he is a person, but you just want to merge. Like that. You don't necessarily get the idea that a Nyaya Vaisheshika, that they have any problem that the Lord in his form is eternal. It's just they're only interested in liberation. Right? So then it's mentioned that knowing that the Lord has form and then wanting to merge is a more unfortunate position than not knowing he has a form. Because there is the chance that once you understand he has a form, you might take up devotional service. But knowing the form and then come to the conclusion of merging into the Lord, then that's sad. You know, because you could have gotten so much more. You got to that point. You're liberated. You're directly seeing the Lord face to face. You could ask for devotional service. You could take up devotional service. But instead, you just merge. So that's, you've gone so far. You know, you worked so hard. You finally, after, you know, 20 years, met the big guy. And when you get there, you just ask him if they can, you know, move the little sign that says no parking that's in front of your house and move it down 10 feet to the, you know, to the where the apartment building is, because no one cares if one's in front of the apartment building, but, you know, it's in front of his house, it just doesn't look good. You know, he could have asked for so much more.
Is that because the Prabhupada says, until you made a pure devotee, you will remain in Brahmanism?
Yes. You can't go beyond that. Because here is Paramatma, even though you've accepted that here is the form of the Lord that bestows the results, director of action, pervades the universe. You accept that, but it's only localized. So you can either see as, okay, you have it means either from the element of you know, just the Brahman has taken this temporary form, or that's if you're taking that aspect, but then or it's the reflection, because in the Dvaitavada you have to have one of those two, you know, the that like the sun reflected in the pot of water, so it reflected in your heart, you see, but actually there is not everybody has this super soul at the same time, so they'll take it, it goes back to its one. Like that. And that means no form. Well, we take it the opposite, and we'll use the same example of that reflectionism, is that there is only one supersoul. Right? Means Kiradaksha Vishnu is one person, but he's expanded into everybody's heart. You see it as many individuals as you see many suns in the so many pots. But actually it's just one sun. So it's the same person. It's not that your supersoul is different from the next person's supersoul. Is that okay?
So they're not meeting the pure devotee because
they don't want to. That's okay. Like that. So the point is you'll never meet a pure devotee, you know, unless you want to. And why would you want to? You don't know they exist. Does that make sense? So in other words, you'll remain here eternally. So why does one actually come in contact with the pure devotee? Because the pure devotees, they want to go out and contact the living entities. So they actually create your fortune. That's what Prabhupada means. I made your fortune. Is he goes out. You know, it's like, it's not that any of the guys down on, you know, the Lower East Side had any actual interest in real spiritual life. It's just Prabhupada happened to go there. Right? By the order of his guru. And Lord Chaitanya, ultimately Lord Chaitanya's order to go every town and village. So now here Prabhupada was in the village, right? Right? Like that. And so then from there, then they come in contact. And then from that, they're interested. You know, it's not that, I can't remember who saw it. I think it was Satsarup or I agree with something. They're walking down the street, they see Prabhupada, and they say, who's this? You know, I think it was Hayagriva. He knew about Indian swamis and like that. So it's like, oh, hey, here's somebody. He's a professor. So for him, it's just a cool person to talk to. Right? He's an intellectual. He likes to intellectualize, and Indian sadhus are kind of intellectual, so this could be good. Right? He's not thinking, wow, finally, a pure unalloyed devotee of the Lord, now I can attain pure devotional service and that, you know. That's not wise. He's just thinking, cool. Right, you know, going over and then meeting Prabhupada. Then he's taking it. From contacting, then that Sukriti is there. Now his, you know, material life is ruined, you know. And so therefore, then gradually by the association, then they come into pure devotional service. So it's by the association of devotees, by the devotees going out. Right? Now the devotees are doing that, going out, but it's not that the living entity has a sincere desire to meet a pure devotee. The living entity may have the interest to know God, but they don't even know who God is to know God. They just want to know. So because you can't know from the material platform, you can only know from the pure devotees, Krishna will put them in contact. So it basically all goes back to still it's the desire of the individual and the desire of the Lord and the living entities. So that's actually what's interacting.
So how does it work if we're looking at it in a balance? Let's say I have little desire to know God. It would seem if I meet a very advanced devotee, that desire is going to increase a lot. Or if I meet just any devotee, nothing may happen. Is it true, or is it always within the individual that Krishna will always arrange to send the right person?
He'll always send the right person. Because if you check, actually, of all the devotees, you know, that have, you know, have come to the stage of Shraddha and moving on, if you ask them who they met that they first sparked the Krishna consciousness, generally it's always going to be a neophyte. Very rare it'll be that first meeting was a Madhyama or Uttamadhyama. So that means is the potency of devotional service is there in everybody. The potency of the holy name, the potency of the instruction. It's just how much the person's realized. The advantages, in other words, if you're coming in contact with the pure devotee, they're able to present the pure devotional service from so many angles for your benefit. So you're coming in contact with pure devotional service and it's able to be seen and explained. While the neophyte, you're coming in contact with pure devotional service, but they may not give the nice example or may not be able to explain it. You know what I'm saying? There's no such thing as neophyte electricity. There's only electricity. So pure devotional service, there's only pure devotional service. So devotional service means pure devotion. Now it's coming through the person does how much. So therefore, copper will carry more, but silver carries more than that. You know, but then you know, aluminum, you know, does okay, but it's less than that. But it's just the electricity that's coming through is the same quality. You know, we tend to make it that because I'm the doer, therefore I'm able to give pure devotional service or not. But it's not like that. Pure devotional service is independent. It's not dependent on us. We're simply caring. And we get the benefit for doing that. Because if we don't carry it, someone else. We don't want to show up at that corner, you know, where that guy just happens to be walking around the corner. Then another devotee will be there.
So if I'm carrying a stronger charge, then does it mean I meet this guy, first day he becomes a devotee, if I'm carrying a weaker charge?
No, it's a matter of if whether they're interested or not. The point is by being with it, that the neophyte will see limited ways to engage, limited ways to attract, while the more advanced will see greater ways. So that's the advantage. Does that make sense? That association. But the point is that's just doing the generic. So now, as far as preachers go, the greater their understanding, their commitment, the purity, the greater effect they'll have. So if someone wants to be serious about preaching, he would want to develop more in advancing devotional service so that he could be of greater use in the mission. Is that word? So from the individual's point of view, they're going to look at it from, it's important. The more advanced I am, the more effect I can have. If you're looking at others, you don't look at it that way. Because otherwise, then it's like, well, if they're not a pure devotee, then, you know, they can't preach and all. Somehow, anybody can preach. Anybody can give a class. Anybody can be, you know, this and that. You know, be a guru. But at the same time, the gurus can't be gurus. You know, it's a very interesting cocktail of insanity. You know? But it's just weird. So to avoid that side of it, that's why we started off explaining it in that way. Just understand the generic. Devotional service is devotional service. Otherwise, we'll make it out that we're the cause of devotional service and we're the, you know, because then that's why the person is still a sadhu. He's making a mistake, he's still a sadhu if he's committed to devotional service. Doesn't mean he's not distracted by inappropriate activity or thoughts, but he's still connected to the devotional line, so the potency is still there. So this thing is, oh, if he has that thought, he can't be a guru. He never was a guru, or none of this like that. Never was a devotee. These kind of statements aren't actually useful. If you're saying he was never a devotee means he was never on the platform of prema, yes, you could say that. That you could confirm. But to say he wasn't a devotee means he wasn't ever actually a real practicing devotee. He was just a pseudo-devotee. That's extremely dangerous. Extremely dangerous. Like that. So the general devotee should never use that. But they're generally the ones that use it.
But isn't it also, from a psychological point of view, the person's admittance of their own defect? Because...
But the point is that when they admit their own defect, what is everybody else supposed to do with it? Right? Means we're talking about, no, we share, we're all together, everybody has the right to know, and it's all about the individual and everything like that, and everybody's rights and all that. So, you know, for the greater good of everyone, because everyone has the right to know, now you tell us everything, all the confidential things, what you're doing wrong. Okay? Right. Now, if it is just, Joe Schmo, then it's okay. They'll tell, okay, don't worry, everything's all right. Now if he's in a position of authority, now you tell everybody, and see, he never was, and he's not this and that. It's totally inconsistent. So all it is political tricks. It has nothing to do with all those nice words. You're not dealing with real bohemians here. You're dealing with politicians that just know that the bohemian language. It works in the general public. But amongst politicians, they don't use it. When you get those people in the room, they talk hardcore, rough, tough, nasty stuff. But as soon as they come out in the public, then they're all touchy-feely and all. So it's not real. So it's not applied. It's not the etiquette. It's not all these things. So the whole point is that this so-called truth is Krishna. So the point is that's why they're still able to. They make devotees, and they still come in contact and do all these different things. They still have potency. They still have power. But it's not ideal because the steadiness, the stableness, these are the things in question. Right? Like that. They won't necessarily be able to give a good example or these other things like that, but to say they're not a devotee or these things are statements of neophytes. These are not statements of persons who understand the philosophy. Like that. In certain situations, the statements that may have to be made to save the neophytes who don't understand, who can't discriminate. But at the same time, it's not standard. One may do that. But it's not the natural Vaishnava anything at all. So to use it as that's normal, that's wrong. That's just the inability to discriminate, the lack of intelligence. You know, it's just like there's a blemish on the potato, so the whole potato is thrown out. No, the part that's not useful, you cut that out. The rest of it's still good. Because if we work by 100% or zero, 100% is prema. That means there is no one. If they're not on the platform of prema, then they're nothing, according to this philosophy. So the point is, but since the soul's inherent nature is to be on that platform of prema, it's just a matter of developing it. So that means every soul has something of value.
Isn't the philosophy also, because I'm not on prema, nobody else can be?
That's there, that of course. That's why then the thing is pointed out that
if everyone's as bad as me, then
because it's always thought that what in that situation what I do, that's what you've done, and so then therefore then we'll make a decision based on that because we never want to talk to the person because it's a committee and we're all intelligent, we know what's going on, so we don't need to actually talk to the person, and so that way we work out everything but based on what we would do if we were sinful, what we do in that situation. So it's just like you said, it's self-centered. So that's why then that point is being made that if someone may join at the same time or later than you, then advancing, even if it's beyond you, the Vaishnava is actually happy to see that. If someone's jealous or this, or how can they be, we were new bhaktas together. As soon as you hear that come out of somebody's mouth, then right there that conversation has lost its usefulness. You know, if it's between the two of them and the one has attitude and the other thing like that, then that's between them. That's not our conversation. You know, you have one big guy and another big guy. Who's he to say that? You know, we were doing, you know, so that's not. Then that's another thing. But if you're dealing general principles and all that, then that's not correct. Okay. In scriptures, Paramatma is called Purusha. Paramatma has two forms. As the form of the universe, Samasti Prakash, and as the friend of the soul, situated in the heart and being the size of the thumb, Vyasti Prakash. Okay? So the Samasti Prakash, that means the universal form. Right? Because Kiradakshaya Vishnu is the universal form. But also Garbhadakshaya Vishnu is the universal form. So in other words, the universal form, the elements that are there and how his potency has gone into everything, that's Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. But now, controlling that, what does what results you get, all that, that's as Kiradakshaya Vishnu. And Kiradakshaya Vishnu and Garbhadakshaya Vishnu are the same person anyway.
Yes.
Right?
So Maharaj, the universal form has nothing to do with Brahman.
The universal form is Brahman. But the thing is what we're talking about here is, so you can say Garbhadakshaya Vishnu is the Brahman aspect of the universal form. And Kiradakshaya Vishnu is the Paramatma aspect of the universal form. Does that make sense? So in other words, in the universal form you have both aspects, Brahman and Paramatma. That's what I was saying, is Bhagavan's beyond this. And that's why in the second canto it's mentioned that the Brahman and Paramatma realizations are actually realizations of this world. They're not mundane, but they're spiritual realizations that one has here. Because in the spiritual world, it's only Bhagavan. There is no Brahman and Paramatma aspect. I mean, it's not like that. It's the person who you feel everywhere and see everywhere and see in all your works and why you do everything. So it's already included. Brahman, Paramatma are already just part of Bhagavan. You know what I'm saying? If those indulging in karma have an inclination to the Lord, they become worshippers of Paramatma. Just as the last stage of contemplation is a realization of Brahman as the object of worship, so the last stage of karma leads to realization of Paramatma as the object of worship. So that's the next, the natural stage. So it's interesting in that, in one sense, it seems that it's going. Yeah. So in this way, then the yoga is higher, because there's the concept of the person. Then you're just regular Brahman. But then if they get to there and then drop back into it, then it's, you know, sad. The third and ultimate realization of the Lord is Bhagavan. Bhagavan refers to the supreme entity, endowed with form, powers, and all qualities. There is no independent entity except Bhagavan. He is endowed with energies, and by his inconceivable energies, he manifests all the souls and universes. So it says he manifests the souls. That means that they're always there. Because he's unlimited, and he's all potency, so that means all the potencies are always there. That's just him. That's who he is. Right? So jivas become manifest.
Yes.
It's just like the material energy becomes manifest. It's always eternal. It's always there. Right?
This point that Prabhupada makes about yogis wanting cities. We're not reading about cities here. We're reading about merchants. So what's the...
Because we're starting at Brahman. We're not working with yogis who are simply doing it as a subtle form of, or metaphysical form of how you say, materialism, like that. We've already dealt with the, because they'll all just go into the, there would be, you know, they would be just according to what class they're in there. But we're talking about God realization here, so then that aspect of yoga is not being done. Just like, you know, we started with the theistic moralist. So the third level of knowledge. And so they don't know much about God or this or that, but there's, you know, an interest, and, you know, and a willingness to connect that whatever goes on is connected to God. So it's a platform you can work from. So the yogi, whatever is platform, but then there's going to be some understanding of Paramatma. So that aspect we're taking. We're not just like in the karmi, we're not taking anything else. Or he's a religionist, we're not taking that. We're simply taking that state of consciousness, being situated in the third state of consciousness. Because if you're theistic, then you can move from Brahman to Paramatma to Bhagavan. Right? If you're atheistic, then it's more of a problem. So therefore, that's why within the theistic moralists there's two types. Those who are pseudo-theists and those who are real theists. Because a pseudo-theist will say God has a form, but it's temporary. And the ones that believe it's eternal, they're real theists. Like that.
Does it mean all the yogis are first achieving mystic cities before they evolve to this point that we're talking about now?
Or? They could be cultivating it all along. But by their system, then it's not until you have realized the Lord. You know, that you means you started the meditation that you really seriously focused on the Lord. But someone can be already, you know, Vaishnav or spiritual before they start. Like that. So, you know, it can work. It's just a very slow mechanical system. That's the difficulty. That's why it's not recommended. You know, your back's out of shape, great. But if you want self-realization from it, it's not going to happen. Because yoga, self-realization from yoga means 24/7, you know, for however long it takes. It doesn't mean 20 minutes a day. That's not, you're not going to get anything out, cities out of that. But the cities, then they may come along before that. Generally, I think that they would be offered first. Because the thing is merging into Paramatma, and it says that's the final snare of Maya. That means for those who are just attracted by anything other than that have already been distracted before. So the cities would already have distracted them before they get. So probably of the yogis, not necessarily all of them make it to the point of full realization of Paramatma, because they've already been distracted by mystic cities. And then those who make it there, then she distracts them by thinking, this is me. And then those who make it past that, then they take up the emotional service. That work?
I just find it just the manifestation of the cities, just that they manifest through yoga, they don't manifest through other processes and the function
you can,
of them.
It's, yeah.
You're just there as it's Krishna create that process just another way of bewildering them.
I mean, how do you get lunch? You have to use cooking. You know, you do office work on a computer. You can't take your pots to the office or bring your computer into the kitchen. You know, so it's just, it's the way Krishna's made it. You want siddhis, and yoga is how you get it. It means anything that you do in practice, you get some siddhi in it. Because you're able to make something very difficult look very easy. So it's a siddhi. It's just that they're not necessarily mystic siddhis. Right? So then that means then you have to do something, you know, of greater austerity. You know, stop breathing, stop eating, you know, stop any activity, stop the senses. So, you know, for that then, what do you get? Better facility with the senses, better facility with the mind, and that, you know, better facility what you can see or travel or do. You're doing nothing, so then you can travel anywhere. You're stopping the breathing, therefore, you know, the life is longer. You stop thinking about anything, therefore you can understand everything. You know, these, it's just, you know, because generally the one thing is comes from the opposite, right? My power of spending is because of the power of making. If while I'm making, I'm spending, my power of spending later is less. You know, so the whole point is because, and because you're spending, you're not making. So it's natural. It's a natural balance. That makes sense? So yoga is where the most extreme, where you're stopping any activity, you know, and so therefore then that would create perfections in activity. Does that make sense?
And then what do? You're a yogi, you're living hundreds of years, what's your daily program? Once you have these cities, I mean, you can do anything you want.
Yeah, but they don't, because then you lose your city. why does the miser not spend his money? Right?
So it's an ultimate paradox.
Yeah, so that's why it's all, everything's useless in the material world. Yeah, whatever your position, you think that position will make me happy, but it's not. Like that. Everything's dependent on desire. You want, then it happens. You don't want, it doesn't happen. So the person wants money to have the money, not to spend the money. Right? The person who wants money to spend it is already spending it as they're making it. The person who wants money to have money is not spending it. Like, because money means the security or possibilities or like that. So as soon as you spend it, you lose security, you lose possibilities. So it's just a matter of how you perceive it. So the same way, you're saying, there are ones that use it. You know, you don't hear much about them because it disappears. And other ones who are careful, they use it where it'll be of something of value. You know, like an intelligent, wealthy person is comfortable to spend money where it's of use to spend it. But he won't spend it where it's not.
So what would the yogi spend his cities on? That's useful.
Going to, like, you know, Brahma's planet for a sabha there, like that, or it's cold out, keeping warm. You're hungry, not getting disturbed by that.
Making an aerial palace for your wife.
Yeah, making an aerial palace for your wife. You should try that one sometime. You know, I, you know, have a house here, house there, you just take it with you.
Hard enough to just make one palace of bricks.
Well, you can make a flying palace of bricks. Okay. The possessor of the energies and the energies are non-different. So that way there is no difference, because God and his energies, it's non-different, because his energies, it's him doing it. Otherwise, if we separate it, see, the separation is in the consciousness. The consciousness is separated, but in substance, you're not separated. We're just a small amount of a particular kind. He has unlimited energies. We're one energy, and we're a portion of that energy. But we have imbued with individual consciousness. Therefore, we can interact. Right? So that oneness, if it's too much oneness, then we'll see there's no difference between us and the Lord. If we make too much difference, then the Lord and his... The Lord manifests through his internal potency, right? That's a common sense, right? The Lord, you know, manifests through his internal potency to perform his wonderful leelas. So that means what you're looking at is internal potency. So the form of Krishna is his internal potency. And it's appropriate for the situation. He'll be bigger or smaller. Brahmaloka will be bigger, he'll be smaller. You know, the particular aspects, what he manifests for Mother Jashoda is different from the gopis, different from the cowherd boys. Right? You know, means for Mother Jashoda, he just has to look nice, look cute. For the gopis, it has to be beyond cute. And for the cowherd boys, it doesn't need to be cute, it's just that, you know, he has to be interactive. So it's just a matter of, you know, what aspects of his potencies he's manifesting. So they're non-different from him, so it is him. His form is him, at the same time as he is everything. So the point is you have to have a balance between the two. And if you look, and even if you say, you know, Advait, so all the Advait, Vishuddha Advait, Vishishta Advait, they're all too much on one side, or Advait's too much on the other side. If you say, okay, Advait, Advait, but you're looking at one or the other, if you get that perfect balance, it's the Chintaveda Veda Tattva. Then inconceivably, simultaneously, one. Like that. And different. If the souls and universe are the transformations of the Lord's energy, then they cannot be different entities from the absolute point of view. Right? But from the soul's point of view, the possessors of all energy cannot be considered the same as the energies. Right? Does that make sense? This is the important part. So from the Lord's point of view, he looks more at the non-difference. We look at more the difference.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, just like the father, you know, for the son. You know, my son, you just see it as part of the scene and taking over, and he's just the same as you. And the son, he says, you know, there's the old man, you know, then there's me, that guy. You know what he said? He says, the son, it's my room, right? For the father, it's a room in his house that the son uses. And he's happy the son uses. Right? So the father sees the oneness, the son sees the difference. And I'm not sure what the Holy Ghost sees. Therefore, the souls in the universe are separate entities from God from the conditioned point of view. If both difference and entity are not accepted, the real truth can never be found. So you have to be able to accept the difference. Now there's a start, because in other words, there's a difference. Because on the conditioned state, yes, there's a difference. See, in here, these points, we see where these are points, that these are proper philosophical points that the Maya bodies take and then make their philosophy. They only take that point, this kind of point. Mm-hmm. So you have to, in other words, you're establishing the difference, but how we're seeing the difference is not actually where the difference is. Does that make sense? Then you make this difference and everything, and then having made the difference, then you engage in devotional service. Right? So then that oneness is of the mood, the difference is that the ability to perform the service. Right? But the point is you're just God's energy. So if you're just God's energies, then what's your position to be the independent, complete, supreme controller? So that aspect of conditioning the living entity is removed. Right? So therefore, he can't be the conditioned. But at the same time, as you say, okay, well then they're all one, then where's the service? Where's the difference? So therefore, you focus on the difference. You're not God. You're not the material energy. Right? Because the idea is, I am this body, I am God. Right? Now that's really contradictory. But whatever it is, it works. Right? So the point is you're not God and you're not the material body. One big boy or many small ones. Does that make sense? So you make that difference. So here, if both difference and identity are not accepted, the real truth can never be found. You have to be able to understand both. So we can say it's all one, and we can also prove that it's all different. But you have to be able to adjust with both of them simultaneously. Then you can find the real truth. Someone may argue that such a contradictory proposition is not possible, or that it cannot be established on logical grounds. However, this principle is intrinsic to God. By the Lord's inconceivable power, opposite attributes coexist. Because if everything comes from God, everything that's contradictory eventually gets back to God. So if it gets back to God, that means all contradictory elements are reconciled in God himself. So it's not contradictory. Right? As energy, it may be contradictory. But as energetic, it's not.
Inconceivable.
Yes, that's the inconceivable. The use of logic is by its nature limited, because you're using a material element, right? Connected with the mind. So two material elements, then with the senses. And so you're just using mundane to try to understand transcendental. It can't work. Right? Is that? Logic cannot fathom this principle. But once fathoming this principle by the Lord's grace, then you can actually be logical. Then you see the illogicality in the logicalness of those who are consider themselves logicians. Okay. Innumerable opposites. The Lord's free will and his unchangeable nature, nirvikar. Right? These are innumerable opposites. This is still all Bhakti Vinod, right?
Yeah.
So now here you have all these things that are opposite. Lord's free will and his unchangeable nature. Because free will means you're constantly changing. Anything you like, you do. So to do something means a transformation. To have the will to do it means the will has transformed. In other words, the mind is transformed, the activities of the senses have transformed. So it's transformation. But he's unchangeable. So actually, therefore, he's unchangeable. What changes? His will, I mean, the energies fulfill his will. So still, you know, on that ultimate, but it's still the same thing. It's still Shakti Parinamabha. It's just now whether it's external energy Shakti or internal potency Shakti.
Or you can say like the different avatars or different forms that he takes, he's still unchangeable.
It's still him. Yeah. It's still the same person. Yeah. Like that. But still he's doing that through his internal potency. So that he looks like Nisringa, or he looks like, you know, Ramachandra, or he looks like, you know, Krishna, Lord Chaitanya, looks like Krishna in Vrindavan. It's still the internal potency. It's still his potency through he manifests. It's still Shakti Parinamabha. Does that make sense?
Well, because generally, I was thinking we make the distinction between Vishnu Tattva and Shakti Tattva. So
yes.
When you say internal potency.
Internal potency, yeah. It means the Shakti is arranging this.
Okay.
But that's his form. So that's the thing, is that Bhaktivinoda points out, is that you have something, but it's in the same potency, but you can still tell the masculine and feminine element.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like you have dog. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's a generic quality that makes a dog. You can still tell feminine dog, masculine dog.
Mm-hmm.
So you can still see, there is Brahman. Mm-hmm. But you can still tell what's feminine Brahman and what's masculine Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's very... It's not an area that's very important. It's only important on this side as much as we are trying to identify with material energy, you know, gross or subtle, and trying to be the controller and enjoyer. So it's the Lord does it. It's just that, so that one sees that if he's free will, he does, and he is unchangeable, nirvikar, because his energies change. He doesn't change. But at the same time, is how do you change something that's everything? You know what I'm saying? So if he is everything and the potency of everything, so whether something manifests or not manifests, for him it's no change. He's still the same, unlimited, all-potent entity.
Mm-hmm.
But for interaction and pastimes, it appears there's a change.
Mm-hmm.
So again, here's where the Mayavadis will take off. It appears there's, you know, forms here. There isn't actually. But no, it appears there's forms. That means it's not the Lord. Because that's a form. If it's all the Lord, then how does Krishna sit and wait for Radharani? Because he's just waiting for himself. And then, you know, the others will come along and console him, but it's just himself consoling himself. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's a limit how much he can do, unless he's got unlimited vata. Then how does he go on and just thinking that, you know, be just happy doing his own little dramas with his own little, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So the thing is therefore the Mugdutta aspect is he himself doesn't even, he himself comes under his own yoga maya, so that he doesn't think that I am all this. You know, otherwise he's sitting there in anxiety, when's Radharani going to come, and then, well, actually I know that, she'll come at this time and all that. You know, so, you know, I could do something else. But no, it's so he can taste these things, because the rasa is what it's about. He is everything. He is the all-potent, all things, all wealth, everything that we just desired since time immemorial. But he who has all this, that's not what's important. That's just his existence. Like, okay, you have an arm, right? But the point is that's not the big deal. It's what you do with your arm, right? Now, a person without an arm, he's looking at people with arms and wish he had an arm. You know, so the person with the arm, and oh, my arm's so tired and all that. The other thing, you're nonsense. You know, if I had an arm, I would get even more tired. You know, it's like, you know, does that make sense?
I'd give him a run out of the arm.
Yeah, get my run out to have an arm. Does that make sense? So the thing is it's someone who doesn't have it, who desires it and thinks it's important. But the person who has it, it's just normal. It's what you do with it. In other words, you have a car, it's what you do with the car that's fun. You have a house, it's what you do with the house. The guy with no house, he wishes he had a house, and then I do all these things with it. But for God, being God is not important because he already is God. Nothing can change that, so that's just who he is. Right? So what you do, so therefore for him, rasa is what's important. So it's the interchange. So that, therefore, the element of that degree of muktata. So in Vrindavan, that degree of muktata is complete because everybody there is completely endeavoring to please him. That complete surrender, so he can completely be in that muktata. So you go into Dwarka, then it's basically there, but there's a little bit of not. You go into Vaikuntha, then basically you don't see it. To some degree you do, but you know, because otherwise how does he interact with these devotees? Because it's all the devotees. So he sticks to, you know, that planet. Though he's the lord of everything. You know what I'm saying? So it's just a matter of this element, that Sarvajna and the muktata, they're the, what makes the difference in the guru.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Śrīla Prabhupāda ki,
Jai
Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki,
Jai
Nitai Gaura Kṛṣṇa.